Welcome to the Consumer Insights Podcast. Every episode, we speak with an insights leader from one of the world's leading brands to hear how they're integrating consumer insights into strategy to move business forward. I'm your host, Thor Olav Filogen. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Consumer Insights Podcast. Today, I'm excited to have an incredible insights leader joining me for what I know will be a fantastic conversation. I'm thrilled to introduce today's guest, Laura Eddy, VP of Research and Insights at Realtor.com. Prior to her role at Realtor.com, Laura was head of insights at Bed Bath & Beyond, and she's also held several senior research roles at Zillow, Amazon, and Walmart. Thank you so much for joining me, Laura.
Hi, how are you? I'm very excited to be here.
So Laura, firstly, could you take a couple of minutes to tell us about yourself, your company, and how you got to where you are today? I am quite curious as how you've made the transition from microbial engineering to consumer insights.
Absolutely. As you alluded to, I did start my career in microbial engineering. One of my masters is in that area, and I spent a number of years in industrial biotechnology. I realized, though, very quickly working for Cargill, which is the largest privately held company in the country, they had very interesting ambitions of, we want to be in biotechnology, but we're not really sure what to do with it. So as a scientist, could you work with these marketers to say, how do you sell whatever it is that you create? And in that experience, it became apparent very quickly that people and consumers are much, much more interesting than bacteria and yeast. So I switched over to marketing research, working for companies like General Mills, Lando Lakes, traditional kind of CPGs, and taking that really hard science background and analytics, moving into retail. You know, you've got companies like Walmart, Amazon with these massive data sets. Sometimes traditional market researchers, at least at the time, weren't necessarily quite as analytical. So bringing that skill set to those companies really, I think, opened my eyes, and I hope in some of those cases, the eyes of those companies to really the power of data and attitudinal consumer research together to say, how can we really make our make lives better for our consumers, customers, users, things along those lines. And after being in retail for a little while, I moved over to more traditional tech with Zillow and getting into an area that I've really become passionate about. You know, it's so interesting because real estate is such an integral part of the human experience. It's one of those things that you as a person deal with that really hits on literally every level of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, from like basic shelter all the way through self-actualization. And yet the experience of getting real estate, whether you're renting, buying, selling, whatever, is borderline traumatic for a lot of people. And so if there are things that we can do through research that help make that easier or better, or at least less traumatic, that is a very worthwhile, exciting place to be. And so I've just recently come back into the space after a stint at Bed Bath & Beyond, and very excited to really embrace Realtor.com's vision of how do we make this easier, better for consumers, especially as we're moving into a really challenging economic environment where a lot of people are unsure of what to do around housing. And so it's an exciting time to be in the industry. Like I said, very exciting time to be at Realtor.com, which, to be quite honest, is a little bit of a second place player. You know, a lot of people know Zillow. You've got Zillow, you know, being used in SNL skits, things along those lines. And yet there are certain things that they've done that maybe have dinged consumer trust a little bit. And so how can we at Realtor maybe make that, like I said, ameliorate that distrust a little bit and really become a partner in the process for moving people from a current home to their next home.
And Laura, when you brought the skill set, the unique skill set you have to the world of research, you must have also brought unique perspective. So from that perspective, as an insights leader, how do you define an insight? And also, how has that definition changed over the course of your career? And if it has changed, what made it change?
Oh, wow. That is a super interesting question. I firmly believe that you can get insight from anywhere in the organization. And part of the magic of an insights or research team is really saying, how do I take learnings from all these different spaces, whether it is operations in retail, a consumer satisfaction survey, call center data, whatever it happens to be, how do I bring all of these sources together and really connect the dots to tell simple, holistic story that is going to help stakeholders in whatever part of the business they happen to be in make decisions that are data driven and in the best interest of consumers? And I'll give you an example of one of my favorite insights from kind of my newbie days back at Walmart that really kind of shaped my perception of what an insight was, could be, how it could be formulated, some things like that. Back in 2008, thereabouts, I started at Walmart and actually was brought in because I had had this very analytical background to start their tracking program between store satisfaction, brand perception work, pricing trackers, things along those lines. We went through doing the satisfaction work. You know, you went through the traditional steps of let's run a baseline survey, let's figure out what the drivers are, what the attributes are, and things along those lines. And in retail, there were three main things, at least for Walmart, that really drove satisfaction. You used to hear the executives talk about these in analyst calls all the time or investor calls. And it was fast. How quickly can I get through the store and through checkout? It was friendly. Did someone help me when I needed help in the store? You know, what was the cashier like? You know, the Walmart greeters, fairly famous. And it was clean. Was the store presentable? Were the bathrooms clean? Did the produce look like somebody cared about it? You know, some things like that. And surprisingly, actually, things like price value almost fell out of the equation as far as satisfaction goes, because people had already given credit to Walmart as having high value when they came in the store. So you couldn't really impress them, or it was really, really hard to impress them with price walking in. And keep in mind, in 2008, Walmart had some of the worst reputation scores in the retail industry. And to be honest, quite a lot of American business history. I mean, they were not a terribly respected company at the time going into an economic recession. And the thought was that going into a recession, Walmart scores should go super high. It's a value play, right? And we were looking at CSAT scores, wondering why some of these things weren't going up very quickly. Realized through some correlation analyses that people who rated their cashiers as friendly thought that their wait in line was literally one third the time of people who thought their cashiers were not friendly. And we went in store and kind of watched how cashiers who were rated friendly interact with consumers, things along those lines. And knowing that that ability to get in and out of the store through the checkout line, huge driver of satisfaction, which in turn is actually a huge driver of whether you choose to spend your next visit with Walmart. We watched these cashiers and it came down to really three easy things. First off, did the cashier acknowledge the customer when they came up to their place in line, said hello, made eye contact, and things like that? The second thing was these cashiers smiled, just smiled. They didn't look like they were under duress to be there, anything like that. And the last thing was they said thank you, or some acknowledgement of, we appreciate you being here. And we took these couple of pieces of learning from operations, from the survey, and we put this very simple program together. And we piloted it actually in New England, which I'm not sure if you are familiar with New England, but it's maybe not known as the friendliest, warmest part of the U.S. In fact, they actually have the lowest friendly scores in the country. And we decided to pilot this program there. We put together little laminated cards with say hello, smile, say thank you. I mean, very simple things. Gave it to all cashiers. We put people who were more outgoing in cashier roles, people who are maybe more introverted in stocking roles, things like that. And we watched those scores jump in the course of literally a 6 week to 3 month period, which actually then correlated to higher same store sales, things along those lines. We rolled this program out US wide and ended up actually seeing Walmart same store sales jump. Now, again, there was an economic recession going on. There were economic headwinds, tailwinds all helping all of this. But that was such a learning for me in that you could take this learning from a survey and go in store and talk to operations. And you could make these tweaks that really didn't cost very much for the organization and yet make a fundamentally better shopping experience for customers, which in turn actually materially drove same store sales, impacted that bottom line, so on and so forth. And it was by pulling these pieces from kind of disparate areas together and knitting them in one place where you could see that impact on the bottom line. And I think that is so key for insights professionals to be able to do.
I absolutely love that story, Laura. And when I look at your career, I think it's, you know, you've really had an amazing journey. And one thing that's really interesting about your career and the journey you've been on is that you've worked both with a variety of companies, and as such, I would imagine the full spectrum of consumer involvement and the purchase decisions. And in other words, my guess is that, as an example, the average shopping list for, say, a Walmart or Bed Bath & Beyond is quite different than the one you'd have at Realtor.com. So do you shift your approach to research and insights depending on the level of consumer involvement in a purchase? Or are there some aspects that stay the same regardless?
The data inputs may be slightly different by company. Walmart, Amazon, Bed Bath, they're retailers. They have massive, massive transactional data sets all about how people might shop different categories or how they shop one side of a store versus another, or even online versus in-store behaviors, things along those lines. And of course, Realtor, Zillow, some of these other places, much, much longer, obviously, product life cycle, things along those lines. Most people don't just decide to buy a house 1 week. Some might, but most don't. And so there are differences in just scale of what you're looking at. But still, even housing, huge, huge data sets. I mean, the government has mounds and mounds of data, things along those lines. The thing actually that changes, or I've noticed changes almost more than anything, isn't necessarily just the type of data or the amount of data. It's actually the timeline on which these companies work. So I started my career in traditional CPG, and you think about a General Mills, Land O'Lakes. It might take 6 months to a year plus to launch a new product. You've got months to do in-depth consumer research. You know, if you get a product launch wrong, millions and millions and millions, you know, in sunk cost. In digital, it's a much, much faster timeline. You know, Amazon, Zillow, some places like this, it's fast to fail. Put your MVP, your minimal viable product. Some companies say an MLP, a minimum lovable or likable product. Put it out and iterate fast. Fail fast, iterate, move on, so on and so forth. And in retail, it's very similar in terms of speed. You move from 1 week to the next, what's going to be on an end cap, what your circular is going to be, things like that. And it can be a little bit challenging to adapt to those different modes of timing. You know, you have to get very comfortable with making a decision with maybe 80 or 90% of the data in, say, tech or even retail, something along those lines. Whereas in CPG, I, at least at the time, and it's been a number of years since I was in CPG, you really needed that more complete picture because the upfront costs, those sunk costs were so much greater. So I would say that is something that you have to adapt to kind of between industries. But the fundamentals, really the how human behavior works and how you analyze behavioral data in conjunction with attitudinal data, those are really pretty fundamental to what we as research professionals do. I think it's a little bit of how do you balance the art of doing that with the science of it. Again, that's another thing I think that changes between companies. Sometimes more established big brand companies are maybe a little bit more aware of the art part of this. There's an interpretation. You're sometimes fighting legacy organizations where people still, I feel or I think kind of decisions versus especially tech to a degree retail where it's all about show me the spreadsheet, show me the this. If you don't have, you know, that quantitative sample with stat sig at a 99% confidence level, I don't believe it sort of thing. So that approach of how you need to interact with your stakeholders, that audience can change a little bit. But like I said, that fundamental bringing the art and science together of behavioral, attitudinal data to really tell that story of the consumer and how they interact with either your product, your brand, your services is pretty consistent. You tweak maybe the approach a little bit, but at the end of the day, people are people and they want to feel as though their needs are being met and that the brand, product, service, or whatever that they are purchasing, whatever it is, box of cereal to a real estate agent, has their best interest in heart, is going to be advocating for them to live their best life, whether it's saving money or the highest quality breakfast cereal or getting me the best price because I can look at 37 different potential vendors for something on Amazon, to this real estate agent's going to go in and fight for the best absolute closing price that I can get. That's consistent. And it's all about how do you find the best way to communicate that to your stakeholders in a way that is going to, again, help them make those data-driven decisions that are at the end of the day going to make life better for their consumers, users, et cetera. Tweak of approach, but I think at the end of the day, we're trying to get those same ideas across, solve those same problems.
And I think that makes a ton of sense. But Laura, I'm sure you have dozens of them, but do you have any stories that you could share about times during your career where you could potentially highlight that difference, timeline of which the companies work? Tell us what happens, you know, in a much more fast-paced type, digital type environment.
Sure. I'll give you, like I said, General Mills, and this was back to Scott started my career. I don't even want to say how old I am, but I'm sure anybody can look at my LinkedIn profile back at the turn of the century in my day, young whippersnappers. A new product launch, like I said, might take months to years. We would go through and look at syndicated data sales. We would go through scenario planning exercises to say, okay, if we do this in the marketplace, how is Kellogg's going to respond to this? How is Post going to respond to this? They would collect feedback from potential vendors to say, where are we going to put this on shelves? How are we going to price? You know, exhaustive studies to do some of these things. You wanted to be very sure walking in. Whereas at Amazon, I remember a particular study that we did around Alexa. I was part of the team that did foundational insights when Alexa was launched and presented to the public. In the first iteration, Echo was actually presented, if you might recall, as a very hardware-centric product. This is the best speaker. It has the most number of directions that it responds to because it's circular and it fits best with decor because it's very sleek. Keep in mind, Amazon was actually third to market. Siri was already out with Apple. Hey, Google had been launched already, things like that. And so Amazon was going to compete, like I said, on this very hardware level. They put this out. And yet when we started doing text analytics, you realized that consumers were actually treating Alexa as part of the family. In fact, within the first couple of weeks of Alexa being launched, one of the top questions that was being asked was an iteration of, Alexa, will you marry me? Will you be my boyfriend / girlfriend? You know, whatever, things like this. And we realized that the personal assistant had to be personable. And within a matter of weeks, you literally saw the advertising switch from being this very technical. I mean, this is a product developed by engineers, by a tech company to go into people's homes. And they had to pivot really almost on a dime to become this very consumer-facing, personable, personality-driven product. And so you started hearing Alexa start to joke with consumers, and you saw commercials. Actually, this was driven by a community project that we did. We asked consumers, what would you like Alexa to do next? And part of it was Alexa for pets. There was an April Fool's Day commercial where you had this whole pet talking to Alexa and like a cat ordering this like deluxe sushi tray and a dog breaking a lamp from playing and ordering a replacement lamp before mom could get home. That happened literally in the course of weeks. And so that pivot was very fast. We had to take that data, interpret it, quantify it, because again, engineers, but add this art, unstructured kind of text-based data in a matter of weeks. And it wasn't complete. It, let's face it, Amazon was taking a little bit of a leap of faith in going against what all of these engineers, you know, this is a tech hardware product and we are going to have the best technical specs on the market, to a completely different role. And so it was very exciting to be a part of that.
I can imagine. What a story. Thank you so much for sharing that, Laura. And in your current role, you write that one of your goals is to, I quote, expand the research and insights functionality to enable more data-driven decisions making within the organization. With that in mind, what advice would you give to insights professionals who are looking to elevate the role of insights in their organizations?
So the biggest thing that I've really found through my career, and I think this is especially true in tech environments, is really acting as a unifier for the organization. As a research function, insights in particular, we get a perspective that very, very few functions in the organization have. We see across product, we see across marketing, we see across strategy, we see across operations, things like that. It is an exciting place to be because we can, again, draw the line through all of those dots of what's going on in all of these different places. At the end of the day, we all want to do what's best for our consumer. But what an engineer thinks is best for the consumer may not be 100% just kind of off the cuff what a marketer thinks is the best message for consumers. And it certainly might not be what somebody in operations who's putting packages in boxes or having that conversation with the consumer trying to connect them lifetime to a real estate agent. And so by being able to tell that holistic story, at the end of the day, this is what our consumer is trying to accomplish. And here is why it is so important for that consumer. You know, at Realtor.com in particular, you are figuring out where your family is going to live for the next chunk of time. And let's face it, where you live, how accepted you feel in that neighborhood. Are you able to afford the mortgage? Are my kids happy in the school? Do they have a place to play? That is a hugely emotional decision and weight. And you add to that this complication of for most people, a real estate transaction is literally the highest financial output that they've done to that point in their lives. And it's interesting, we've done some studies where, or there are studies that have been done that show that when a decision that is a super high outlay of resources happens, the human brain has evolved to actually trigger pain receptors. Let's face it, back in caveman days, if you overextended yourself, you might be left out in the cold for winter and eaten by a tiger, whatever that saber-toothed tiger might be coming after you because you overextended yourself, got foreclosed on your cave, and you're out in the cold. Subconsciously, that is a huge thing. And when you are able to help every facet of the business understand and really think with that empathy of look of what our consumer is going through, we're all working together to say, how do we make this easier? At least let's not have 50% of people crying, you know, when they are trying to go through a real estate transaction, or 70% of people during the pandemic having buyer's remorse because they bought a home at a time they're not entirely sure of. That's very motivating to employees. And I think especially at Realtor.com, we call it RDC for shorthand. How do we tell that user story? How do we bring together those market level insights? How do we bring together that transactional data of how people are leveraging online real estate sources to align product and marketing and operations and strategy to all work towards the same goal? And I think a lot of companies would tell you, oh, yes, we're aligned. We're all pulling in the same direction. And yet sometimes when the rubber hits the road, you're sitting in these companies, it's kind of like, you may not be quite as streamlined as you think. And it's a matter of giving, like I said, that research department, that mandate, that ability to come in and say, let's all get on the same page. This is what we are working for. And it doesn't matter what industry it is. There's always higher purpose. That advocacy that I referred to earlier of people want to feel like whoever they work with, brand, product, whatever, is on their side, is making their life better in some way, shape, or form. And when we all realize that in a company, the more effective we're going to be as brands, as products, services. And I think that, again, is a very unique role that research and insights should have the mandate to play and bring the company together with.
I absolutely love that answer, Laura. And I think you're really putting the finger on like an important role we as insights leaders can claim and should claim, you know, in organizations in order to get a seat at the table and actually influence the direction of the companies we work with. Kind of staying on that topic and maybe highlighting a limited set of opportunities you think are core for insights professionals to make sure that they really spend time on. I mean, you've highlighted the fact that we should think about ourselves as a team that can really unify the organization, right? But what else can we do to support true business impact and to challenge the status quo?
Yeah. So one of the big things that I really challenge my teams with is having that seat at the table when decisions are being made, business questions are being asked early in the process. Sometimes it is easy to fall into a habit of organizations, especially organizations that are moving very quickly, to say, I need a study run on da 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 da, or a product manager to say, I need you to run a survey with these questions. Research should be involved much, much earlier. And I think one of the ways that unifying function happens is to make sure and really advocate for that voice of the consumer, customer, user, to literally being like almost sitting on the shoulder of every stakeholder, whatever their function is, and having that voice in their head as they are considering whatever decision they're trying to make about their product, their message, whatever. And like I said, really getting that seat at the table early, being involved in formulating what is the business question that's being asked, not just run a survey. How is the information that we're going to provide you be used in a decision, and what impact it is going to drive? And then, like I said, the last part, and I think it's very easy to skip over this in a lot of cases, is the socialization around the organization. We are expected to move very fast. And sometimes it can be, oh, this group asked this question. Here's your answer. I'm moving on to the next question or the next business question, whatever it happens to be. But in a lot of cases, it's how do we use the learning over here and apply it over here? I think that helps really build cross-functional teams. You know, really, again, it acts as that unifier. We're all working off the same body of information, and people have a much richer understanding of what it is they need to do and why we're doing it, giving the organization a purpose. Does that answer your question? I realize I rambled quite a lot.
No, absolutely. Love the answer you gave. I think it makes a lot of sense. And you're highlighting many very important points, you know, that we can bring with us. And I also know that, you know, you, of course, have an extensive career, but when you were at Zillow, your team went from 4 researchers to 16 in the span of just a few years. Could you tell us a bit more about building and leading that team? What skills did you look for, and how did you think about building the team culture?
Boy, I'm going to share all my secrets here. Oh, man, I have a secret sauce now when I if I ever look for another job.
Well, the listeners will be thankful.
So there are a couple of things I think that are very important. I'll start with skill sets, and then I want to talk a little bit about how I've had success building teams. And even in my current role, I've already taken my team from, I've been at realtor.com for 2 months, just over 2 months. And I've already gone from 5 people to I now have 8, and I've got 4 open positions. So let me just put in a plug. If anyone is looking for a job, please realtor.com, look for careers, 4 insights roles open. Would love to have you. But skill sets, the key thing that I look for is really intellectual curiosity, looking for what is the right question to ask. Let's face it, most people come into, whether it's real estate, whether it's tech, things like that, maybe not knowing a lot about real estate, or they've not worked in tech before, or it's something where you have to learn the industry. We can teach that stuff. What I can't teach is curiosity. I can't teach a willingness to share and collaborate with stakeholders. Like, how can we bring as many pertinent people into the discussion and talk about these stories with folks? So curiosity, I look for the ability to tell stories, the ability to communicate learnings, because you can have the absolute best constructed, tightest, statistically significant learning, data point, whatever. But if you can't communicate why it's important, how it's going to improve the product, the brand, whatever, how it's going to ultimately affect the consumer or user, it doesn't matter. If it just sits on the shelf, quite frankly, you just wasted both your time and money. And then the last thing I really look for is a level of, I'm going to call it ambition, but what I mean by that is this kind of go-getterness, this idea of if I see a problem, I am going to go solve it. I'm going to help with this. I'm going to, if I take that next step, I can get this much of a better learning for my organization. And I really, my hiring philosophy comes down to 3 things. And I learned this from Robert Atencio, who is the former head of insights at Pfizer. He led insights at Walmart. He led insights at Frito-Lay. I mean, he's been around the block. But he always told us, you hire for smart, which is that curiosity. You hire for nice, which is all about that storytelling, that communication, that, you know, piece like that. Sarah Makar at Zillow helped us add potential rock star, that taking that next step, going beyond what was just asked into how do I make this the best it can possibly be within the constraints of the project I'm working on. So that's my hiring philosophy. As far as growing a team, the thing that I have found most effective is really this idea, especially when it's a new insights function or an insights function, research function, that's having to maybe come from a little bit of a deficit. Let's face it, sometimes research can be we have research and we checked that box, you know, like, great. How do you really get that relevancy and that seat at the table? I learned this from my Walmart stakeholders and also Rebecca Messina, who actually used to run a lot of insights research marketing at Coca-Cola. She was the CMO at Uber, actually during their IPO process. Her little nugget that I have just latched onto is this idea of find a project champion. Find somebody, a stakeholder, who is placed within the organization where they can really have an impact. They can make a material change on a business, product, brand, whatever, in a way that is going to move the needle and make them look like a rock star. Give them something to latch on to that makes them really be able to make a difference in the business and who will talk up the reasons why they were able to make that decision. At Zillow, one of the things that we did, and I actually advocate for this in all areas of research, is how can you take a learning from someplace over here, be it another industry, be whatever, and apply it to your situation? There are very few new problems in the world. They just are applied in different ways. I had been reading some papers around the medical industry where if a consumer or patient felt as though their doctor was empathetic, understood their situation, you know, really was sympathetic to, I'm scared, I'm not in control of this situation, I don't face this situation often, so I don't know how to deal with it, I don't have the expertise to handle this. When a patient felt as though their doctor was empathetic, the prognosis and outcome of the diagnosis was statistically significantly better and faster, more of a positive outcome, things along those lines. And if you asked that patient what their satisfaction with the outcome was, they were significantly more satisfied. We looked at that study and went, gosh, those emotional reasonings sound very similar to what people go through when they're buying a home. I don't do this very often. I'm not in control. I can't handle this by myself, although I don't really know that I trust anybody else. Like, oh my God, what do I do? And so what we did is we looked at how do we help agents, real estate agents, be more empathetic. And when we were able to get that tied in, this actually became part of the Best of Zillow program. It tied into we implemented a satisfaction program for agents, things along those lines. When those agents implemented those programs, they're on the phone with their client, they're spending a certain amount of time answering questions, things along those lines. We watched satisfaction scores go up. We watched close rate, transaction rates go up, all sorts of things. That was a huge learning, but I think that ability to be that storyteller, get that project champion, get that stakeholder who said, this study, this learning made a difference in how I was able to drive my business. I got more people from operations actually giving headcount to my team than I ever got from the requisition process of, hey, I need researchers to do XYZ.
That is great advice. Laura, I think this is the part that really hurts because we've got to the end of our conversation today. But there's one last question that I just love to ask, which is, who in the world of insights would you love to have lunch with?
Can I have it be a group rather than a person?
Go ahead.
Okay. I actually kind of want to know what is going on with the Fed. Like, literally, I would really like to hear their reasoning for how they're making some of the decisions. Like, is that a group that is taking into account not just the numbers that they're seeing in terms of economic output, things like that, but how do these folks incorporate, or do they incorporate, the emotional state, the needs, wants, barriers, like the lives of everyday people and how they are making decisions. And that's a little bit of a cop-out given that I work in real estate. And so many of the decisions that the Fed is making really directly affect my industry. But that's an area where it feels like there is opportunity to expand from just that analytical world to really, how are the stories, how are the people that are being affected by these decisions being incorporated into these decisions, or are they? The other person that I admit I would, if I had to give a single answer, is actually John Dick at Civic Science. John is absolutely fascinating. He is hilarious. He has more consumer stories and the most interesting correlations from just the omnibuses that Civic Science runs. I remember I had him come do a talk at Bed Bath & Beyond. He was like, do you know what the number one indicator of whether people tuck in their sheets at night, which is apparently a very polarizing question, your bed sheets. Do you tuck in your bed sheets on your bed? And what is the number one indicator that you will do that? And I remember, you know, like went around the room, you know, is it just how you were brought up? Is it age? Is it all these different things? And it's actually height. Taller people tuck in their bed sheets so they don't kick them out. I was like, that's actually kind of fascinating. I'm not sure what you would do with that piece of information, but it like always stuck in my head of like, huh, the power of correlation in studies. It's just absolutely fascinating. And John has a ton of those. So I find him supremely interesting.
I really appreciate that. Those are conversations I would like to eavesdrop on. Now, this has been such a wonderful and insightful conversation, Laura. It's been truly fantastic to hear your unique perspective on leading insights teams and to learn about how you've successfully integrated insights throughout your career. I'm very happy that you discovered that people and consumers are much more interesting than bacteria and yeast. And if I play back some of the things I've learned today, it's just the fact that you've come to the belief that you can get insights from anywhere in the organization. And it's really about bringing all your sources together and connect the dots, create a simple, holistic story that enables the business to take data-driven decisions. Also, make sure to position the insights team as a unifier in the organization and make sure research is involved much, much earlier. Advocate for the voice of the consumer sitting on the shoulders of all key stakeholders as they consider whatever decision they want to take for the product or message. I know that I've learned a ton from talking to you today, and I'm sure our audience has as well. Laura, thank you so much for joining me, and thanks everyone for listening in.
Thank you.
Consumer Insights Podcast is brought to you by Stravito, the user-friendly enterprise insights platform. To find out more about Stravito, visit stravito.com and make sure to search for Consumer Insights in Apple, Google, Spotify, or anywhere else podcasts are found. Click follow so you don't miss any future episodes. On behalf of the team here at Stravito, thank you for listening.